Hello, everyone. Welcome to Everything is Gay, Even the Straight Stuff. I'm John McDonald, and I'm here once again with my deviously delightful, definitely doesn't run a pie shop somewhere in London, co-host Magnus.
Well, hello, everyone. I think if I was to run any shop, it would probably be maybe a bookshop slash artistic vendors or something. Lots of lovely art prints of gorgeous boys everywhere. What shop would yours be?
When I was younger, I really loved going. We had a amusement park where they had like a Pioneer Village with it, so you could actually like make your own candles and you could like watch them like blow glass into vases and stuff. So I always think I would do something like a heavy period piece like that. So like a candle shop could be really fun where you make your own candles. I can see the appeal of a meat pie shop. Definitely is not something that exists elsewhere. And I really am excited to talk about this today. I want to start off with a question talking about Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street.
Yep, go on.
So the question is, what is kind of the major theme of Sweeney Todd to you?
Ooh, really depends because of the fact that there has been a few different variations of Sweeney Todd. And I would say that the main drive of the movie really depends on the portrayal of the central character. Because in some versions, he's a straightforward, murderous psychopath. In others, he's given a very Shakespearean, tragic backstory and such. Still, you know, still evil through insanity, but there's almost like an aspect of pity as well to him in those variations. So I suppose my question, I counter you with another question of what would be, it depends on what version of the character you're looking at, I would say.
All right. That's actually really good. That brings a lot of the historical part of Sweeney Todd into focus. So the reason that the answer kind of differs based on the version of it is because Stephen Sondheim and his longtime collaborator, Hal Prince, who he convinced to work on the project, have differing views about what Sweeney Todd is about. Stephen Sondheim has gone on record as saying it's an opera about a black operetta, is actually what he calls it, that it's a story about obsession. And Hal Prince sees it more as the story of how a vengeful person is pushed over the edge. All of the kind of Jacobean tragedy and the Count of Monte Cristo nest to it that you see in it actually comes more from the play from 1970 that the 1979 musical is based on. So the play Sweeney Todd by Christopher Bond is what Stephen Sondheim saw, and he fell in love with the concept and said, you know what this needs? Music to go along with the murder. Literally, I think that's actually what he said, but he loved the Jacobean elements. He loved the revenge tragedy of it. He basically, whole cloth, took this play from 1970, and in 1979, he staged a musical that is probably his most intense. It's really an opera. It's not a musical because it is 80%. It's like people call Nightmare Before Christmas a musical instead of an opera, but really Nightmare Before Christmas is also an opera. But Sweeney Todd itself, specifically, like, all the people that have seen it have agreed it's an opera. And what's interesting is that because Hal Prince and Stephen Sondheim never agreed on the theme, so you can actually interpret it both ways and be completely correct, and the ways people have staged it have changed it. When they stage it as an orchestral event or as a progressive rock event, that can change it. You can also see the version of it that's called Teeny Todd, which is Sweeney Todd, but it has smaller set pieces because the set pieces for it are huge in traditional musical staging. But you can also stage it in smaller venues, and they jokingly refer to that as a quote unquote teeny Todd, which makes me chuckle a little bit. So.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to discuss the aspect of space, actually, in a bit. You raise an interesting thing about sets and locations, which there's an interesting contrast within Sweeney Todd in that sense. I just wanted to quickly close up my thoughts on, you said about theming with with Obsession. I definitely agree that Obsession is what you see within the musical and the film adaptation, which I think a number of people, certainly film buffs, might know more that as Sweeney Todd as opposed to the musical. I suppose in a way, who knows Sweeney Todd will really depend on sort of like what approach they've taken, whether they've seen the musical or the film, etc. But that era of the story, definitely Obsession rings true with all of the principal cast, in all of their different ways. I want to touch very quickly on the original source material.
Are you talking all the way back to the Penny Dreadful?
Oh yes. Just to give a little bit of extra knowledge to our listeners. So Sweeney Todd started off as the principal character in A Penny Dreadful from 1846, called The String of Pearls. And the way the character was written there was more of a straightforward villain. He was just basically taking care of his customers through the trap door so he could rob them. And then to dispose of the evidence, he handed it to his accomplice slash partner in crime. In which they were written more as just partners rather than any sort of romantic inclinations, as it were. So it's really interesting because you got a, because of the time period, there's a lot of the contemporary narrative. You'll see the writing is very close to others such as Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, Jules Verne's.
I would actually add in America the stuff that Edgar Allan Poe was doing. So our own Gothic romance has some Penny Dreadfulism to it. So for us across the pond, stuff like Poe would be really close to what a Penny Dreadful would be. So
yes. So what strikes me as really interesting is just sort of the leap in adaptation from like the original source material to the like more, dare I say, modern interpretations. And I think it's actually added some depth by giving more of the background to these characters. One last fact, very quickly. I find it quite, how to put this? I'm only quite touching the fact that we're just shy of a couple of decades of this story being a couple of centuries old now. It's really interesting to see in perspective of like sort of the heritage of this story and this character that's endured up to the modern time.
Yeah. And another interesting thing about Penny Dreadfuls, just to keep on this part of the conversation, characters with names like Beetle and Turpin were actually pretty common character names for Penny Dreadfuls. So to actually name your proper quote-unquote villains of this play basically after stock characters from Penny Dreadfuls is really interesting. And one thing I find interesting too is that when I thought kind of about the purpose of a Penny Dreadful, because the Penny Dreadful was, you know, done on kind of pulp wood prints, it wasn't something that was going to last very long. It was really something for like the younger quote-unquote working-class men of Britain, is that it was sensationalist, it was kind of graphic, it wasn't really highly moralistic. It's kind of like, when I think about Sweeney Todd in the context, it's almost like a reverse incel play, because like the jock Chad the romantic lead who Victor Carver played in the first incarnation of Sweeney Todd, the musical, is really like kind of a star-crossed lover, Romeo, Hamlet style, traditional sailor jock type. And so there's something almost anti-incel about Sweeney Todd, even though Sweeney Todd technically is like the dark hero of it, everyone fails, everyone's bound to die in this piece except for Johanna and Anthony. But it's one of those things where, like, in context, in its time, to have something from that time period still work. And even so, I had a friend that fell in love with the Josh Groban Annaleigh Ashford that's currently on Broadway. She liked it so much, she literally sold a ticket to a different show so she could see it a second night and have Josh Groban sign her program.
Oh, wow.
She talked about the idea of how much delight there was, how it really amped up. And I don't want to speak for her too much, but she was so moved by it, both in how it like developed character and how just good people were at it, being in it, that she was just struck by it as an opera. And she'd gone to see quite a few shows, so that's really something to be struck by something, have it be so fresh and new. Because about every 5 years or so, someone does a new production of Sweeney Todd in some way. Does it have it have it still be able to come across as fresh? It's also kind of been a passion project. When we talk about musicals on stage transferring to film, because we are going to talk a little bit about Sweeney Todd the film, Stephen Sondheim really doesn't like movie musicals, and he was heavily involved in the production of the film. For Burton, who kind of had an obsession with this when he saw it in 1980 and didn't end up getting to make the movie until 2007 when Sam Mendes stepped down, there's a fair bit of obsession around the show altogether. And so the people that work on it have a real passion for the project and for getting it right. And I think you really see in Sweeney Todd specifically, even though it's not my favorite Sondheim show, this is not a show that you can do by halves. This is a show that you really have to go into it. And when you look at the principal cast, especially when you look at Angela Lansbury and Alain Caron, who played the first Sweeney and Mrs. Lovett, a lot of what they discovered about Sweeney and Nellie, which is Mrs. Lovett's first name, is kind of improvised. So a lot of things about a little priest, which is one of my favorite songs probably in Sondheim canon, a lot of stuff that they discovered the darkness in this play came organically from people doing the work. And I think there are some shows where you can just kind of phone it in a little bit. This is not a show where people can phone it in. This is a very intense show where it's a show that almost demands that the people involved in it make choices. It's not something that you can just do by halves. And it is a fairly intense show. It's not a show for children unless they're particular. There are some kids that are pretty morbid. So I guess a kid that isn't like too off put by death could probably enjoy it. But this is the kind of show that easily goes from being an opera to being a hard rock show, because the progressive rock band that did it recently, and people really loved it. Like, it's a show that can go many places and can be done as a review, but it's a show that is really served by its set in the same breath. So
yes, well, it shows that I think that this story, its different incarnations, it's a perfect example of people's love for the macabre. We touched upon the Penny Dreadful earlier and the fact it was written to be sensationalist for the people reading it in London back in the past and such. We've talked about the fact that it gets frequent new interpretations and adaptations all the time. There's a reason for it. We enjoy exploring the darker, more tragic tales of life at times.
And this is probably one of the few Broadway shows that gets put on that doesn't give you that catharsis. So it takes you on this bloody ride through this very fictional, dark, factorial, inhumane London street. But it doesn't redeem anyone. All the good characters really stay good. The two pure characters stay pure. Toby is driven insane, essentially, and he ends up taking Sweeney Todd's place in costume because they make his hair turn white in most of the stage shows. And so that white stripe that Johnny Depp has in the movie kind of allows that tone to set about that white stripe being about sanity and, you know, the idea of an event so shocking that it can literally change the color of your hair. It's not just about the fact the show isn't subtle. It's about the fact that this show doesn't bother with the idea of redemption, which is something that audiences are really used to. So there's something very shocking about no one in the show gets a happy ending, because even, you know, Anthony, who is kind of the hero of this piece, like the true white knight, is betrayed. Johanna literally loses all of her family and her hair and is sent to an asylum. It's an interesting show to succeed because in theater, people normally use and think about the idea of catharsis, the idea of transition, the idea of a true ending, the idea of the reward for the good. And this show doesn't give you any of that. This show basically shoves murder and anger and angst and deprivation in your face and says humans are garbage, and it's not something to be celebrated, but we're also going to give you a 3-hour event that's celebrating how garbage humans are.
You could almost say it serves as an Aesop in that sense. That there, I've always thought that there's elements of Sweeney Todd that feels quite fableish in a way that, you know, sometimes people can be so broken or hurt by events that it's very difficult not to pull yourself out of a downward spiral.
And revenge tragedies really are cautionary tales in some way. I'm thinking specifically of The Count of Monte Cristo. I'm thinking of the Revenger's tragedy. I'm thinking of like Ophelia and Hamlet, even, who is kind of dragged down by Hamlet, and is very innocent victim and all the things. There's a sense of everyone in this play has a motive, except for Joanna, who is trapped. And Anthony, who is just too good to be true as a character, as a sailor, he's very naive. Victor Garber plays him really well in the first show. He's my favorite, Anthony, if I'm to be completely honest. I don't think anyone I've ever seen has played Anthony. His last name is Ho. Let's call his baby what it is. Anthony, the sailor's last name is Hope, and when he arrives in London with Sweeney, as Sweeney is re-arriving in London, he seems to be the only character that does not get the vibe of London town and the grimy black-pittedness of it. He does believe in goodness of people. He doesn't suspect that Judge Turpin could be evil because he's a judge, and then he's shocked when it's found out is wrong. He basically is like, if Gaston was the good guy in Beauty and the Beast, he would be Anthony Hope, which amuses me to no end to think about as an idea.
No, I'm just thinking, I don't know why. Like, sometimes you do see, when it's a tragedy, you usually have one male character and one female character as the survivors. I would have to, like, have a think to give you some examples of that, but it just strikes me that that's, sort of almost like a trope in itself. Like there's always like a couple as the sort of the fated survivors of the terrible events that have occurred, sort of thing.
In 1979, they weren't doing any of the work to make that any different either. So when this came out, this too is really at almost at the start of Sondheim's career in 79, 80. Like
Yes.
this is probably one of his first big productions outside of the shadow of Hammerstein, who he was he practiced under because they knew each other. And so it's kind of interesting that this is one of his most complex works. I feel like because he probably was a little more fearless in doing this, either he had something to prove, or he was just so inspired. And this is also the first starring turn really on stage for Angela Lansbury. Quite famously, she had a lot of trouble getting going in theater and film because she could sing, but she wasn't like a young ingenue. So she had kind of the same trouble as really remarkable actresses like Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, who just weren't playing to that like waifish type that they wanted in Hollywood. And so, like, really, technically, Angela Lansbury's big roles have been in Beauty and the Beast, Murder, She Wrote, and as Mrs. Lovett, which seems weird because when you think about her, you think about Angela Lansbury having all these credentials and being one of the great American standard actresses, but really, her biggest Broadway role was Mrs. Lovett. She originated this character and its humor and its cruelty and her own obsession with Sweeney, her help in sending him over the pit, as it were. And interestingly enough, in the play that from 1970 that this musical is based on, Sweeney's transition to murderer happens in like a page and a half. And something Stephen Sondheim did was actually the introspection you talked about earlier, the songs that help him transition, the space that he really needs to like go from I'm considering murder to actively doing murder, was all Sondheim, because apparently in the actual Sweeney Todd play, it's a very quick transition into murder. It happens very quickly. And I think I like the way Sondheim did it. I have to be completely honest.
Well, it shows the spiral of Sweeney go like slowly circling down towards that path of like obsessive self-destruction. I believe in Yes, in the movie, Turpin sort of like barely gets away and such through circumstance, and that sort of makes Sweeney snap, as it were, and he sort of just loses it.
Turpin is a slippery little eel. In the stage, actually, so this is one of the differences, movie to stage play. In the stage play, there are more songs in between. He gets away like three times in the stage play. He gets out of Sweeney's grasp a couple times. By the way, Pretty Women, great song, unsettling, in and out of context. I've actually seen George Fearn do it with John Barrowman in Putting It Together when it's not in the context of murder, and it's such a different song. But yeah, so the transition in the movie is different from the stage play, but Sondheim actually really liked the way the play tightened into the 2-hour time frame of a movie. And so the Alan Rickman getting away from Johnny Depp in the film actually has a bit more tension because of the speed of it, which is interesting. Because it's almost like the universe wanted to give Sweeney Todd a chance to turn back once and then twice. And then it's too late. He murders his wife. He almost murders his daughter. And he doesn't even know he murders the woman he loved. Like it Mrs. Lovett hands him the tools and then sets everything in motion for him to murder the woman he loved, almost as if Mrs. Lovett's obsession plot is more important than the murder of Judge Turpin, which is kind of an interesting way to think about it. So.
Well, I mean, it's her obsession, isn't it? Like, she's aware of Sweeney's obsession, but to her own obsession is all consuming. That makes sense in her character. I mean, she in a way she sets up her own demise by enacting that. And then she's the one that's pied, so to speak.
It's true. There is a bit of a mousetrap to this, the board game mousetrap, where you set up all the pieces and then you knock them down. And there is something Rube Goldberg-y about Sweeney Todd as a musical, where things get set up and knocked down, and then it goes from people being in control of their destiny to being out of control of their destiny fairly quickly.
It's interesting that, in a sense, at the start of the narrative, Judge Turpin is like the more evil, quote unquote, of the characters present, whereas very much Sweeney is sort of like promising revenge and such, and he's doing it out of his obsession. But slowly over time, Sweeney starts to lose it more as he begins to murder, and then loses it completely and just starts killing for the sake of, like, sort of taking his shot back at the world. And in a way, he then outpaces Turpin from the evil stake. So I wonder whether, in a sense, Turpin was put there not just as a psychological goal to give Sweeney more backstory, but almost as maybe a post to mark against, as Sweeney sort of goes over the edge and becomes the more devilish figure, in a sense, by that point.
Johnny Depp has stated pretty heavily, and he's the only Sweeney Todd character I've ever seen anyone do an interview on, because I didn't do any research about whether George Hearn or Michael Ball or Brian Michael Stokes had talked about their turns. Michael Severus probably did. But when you see Michael Severus play Sweeney Todd, there's something very playful about how Michael Severus does, like, he's playing with his meal instead of being as serious as other Todds. So he probably has a very interesting take on it. And Josh Groban's take on it is apparently wonderful. So I hope they do an interview with him. But Johnny Depp specifically said he played Sweeney as sort of a walking corpse of someone that was already doomed, someone that was already dead. The stage makeup they did for the film, the focus on the eyes was very intentional. They wanted to give you that idea of a person that's already a shell at the start, that it's not about the transition into the shell, but that he's already there, and by virtue of returning, he's already doomed himself without knowing. All the characters in the show are really doomed in a lot of ways. I will say that if Stephen Sondheim had not done this, and you didn't have levity like in songs like The Worst Pies in London, or in A Little Priest, which is a hilarious song, and you know you should laugh, but it's hilarious. If you didn't even have pieces like By the Sea that are really dissonant and almost sweet in a perverse sort of way, if you didn't have the love story kind of subplot with Johanna and Anthony, this would be a really hard show to sit through. I don't know how much it differs from the 1970 play. I'd be curious to see the straight play itself. But I have a hard time picturing how you'd be able to sit through if it was just straight up murder, how you could sit through it. The only misstep I ever really had from the film was I just can't stand Sacha Baron Cohen. I find him unbearable on film in a really bad way, charismatically speaking. I think he's the only miscast I have from the film, but the show itself really doesn't let Sweeney off the hook. He starts off as a ghoul with a goal, and it doesn't get any better from there. The reveal of the beggar woman as his wife who had driven herself insane is actually probably one of the better reveals in Broadway too, because when I saw the show and I saw a VHS copy of the original show, you really have no idea. You really do just think that beggar woman is part of the chorus, because the whole city essentially is a chorus that Sweeney doesn't really interact with until he's murdering them. Which is why the movie is interesting, because the chorus was cut. And famously, Anthony Stewart Head was part of the chorus of people that were supposed to come in to lead you into the tale and to do all the singing. And they cut it. They cut Chris, they cut the guy that played Saruman, and they cut Anthony Stewart Head out of the Sweeney Todd. Anthony Stewart Head has like one cameo line, but he had a much bigger role if they had done like the traditional three act, if they had done the traditional musical as the film, he would have had a much bigger role. But yes,
Oh, that's a sad fact to hear about poor Anthony. Hey, at least he had some minor presence then. But I mean, how can you ignore Anthony, for God's sakes?
Well, it's kind of like the. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, you play it, please, please.
What's interesting about the show is it's an ensemble show, but there have been an incredible amount of talented A-listers who have gone through the show. Even if you just count Audra McDonald as Johanna in a couple of the revivals in smaller roles. Actually, I think Audra McDonald might have played the beggar woman. But the idea that Victor Garber played the first version of Anthony and then would later go on to originate Jesus and Godspell is just an amazing thing to sit with. Gaddon Matarazzo from Stranger Things, who plays Tobias, plays Toby in this updated version, is doing an incredible job, apparently. And from winning Olivier Awards to winning Helen Hayes Awards to winning Broadway Awards, like, people have really kind of come into their own using Sweeney Todd in order to do it. And it's been done in almost every country. A lot of the Wikipedia page notes different versions of it have been done all over Europe. South Africa has done it. I think there's a Korean version which had a principal Asian American cast. They're just the diversity of people that really glom onto this story of murder and hopelessness is kind of incredible in the way that kind of the great American Death of a Salesman is really popular in Asian countries, and I'm always mystified when I hear that. Sweeney Todd is just really popular with people, and like when we talk about theater needing catharsis, Sweeney Todd is kind of proof that if you tell a good story, even a downer one, you kind of don't need the redemption arc at the end. Like, everyone can really die. It's okay.
Yes. Well, you mentioned before about Sweeney having the visuality of a walking corpse and such. And I would like to add to that, realistically, if he had got his revenge, if his obsession had culminated in the desired outcome he was looking for, what would have been next for him? Like, when you suddenly lose what's become the focal point of your existence that has been, that you've sort of been plotting and scheming for years of your life, all of a sudden, what do you do with that void? And then also the maybe even start to feel the knowledge of what you've done in order to achieve that. In a way, he would have lost all the motivation, I think, to continue.
Well, and that void doesn't exist in the original Penny Dreadful. In the original Penny Dreadful, Sweeney Todd is just out to avenge people by either murdering the rich because they're rich and they have too much, or murdering the poor to get rid of, to give them the mercy of death out of being poor and out of poverty. So there's no real version of Sweeney Todd that ever gets a redemption. And Mrs. Lovett is kind of the same. She doesn't get redeemed. She has kind of this really great, she's not a ghoul, she's more of a Miss Havisham Great Expectations character, where she's been waiting in a wedding dress for Benjamin Barker to return. Doesn't know if he's going to, but she's just been like living beneath his vacant barbershop, waiting for him to maybe come back, reset with the lie that his wife, who is not dead, is dead. She definitely infers the death. And I think this is one of the things that Angela Lansbury does really well. I would love to see the Imelda Staunton version because I loved Imelda Staunton in her role when she played in Follies. But I can imagine Imelda and Angela probably do the best. I have heard some great things about the Christine Baranski, the Beth Fowler, and my friend was like, Annaleigh Ashford did an amazing job in it. So there's something about how you cast your Mrs. Lovett that will really help push your Sweeney Todd to greatness. But that Mrs. Havisham character is really useful in this, in kind of like her own decrepit, not quite ghoul, but like faux porcelain doll thing she has going on. They do really great because you can't tell if it's dust or if it's flour, but it's like a perfect counterpoint to kind of that pale, dark makeup they tend to give. George Hearn, if you've never seen George Hearn, they do this thing with makeup where it looks like his kind of face starts to droop and extend in my mind. Like the white, the way they pale his face makes his face kind of look like it's starting to like extend and drip and become even less
Oh,
human throughout the course of the show. George Hearn's makeup
what?
for Sweeney, like when you see George not in the makeup versus George in the makeup, it's kind of the most amazing transition that you could imagine. Because like Angela Lansbury really does look like herself as Mrs. Lovett with some like girlish pigtails, but like George Hearn in that pale makeup, like it just changed his face. And I never got to see Michael Severus in his Sweeney makeup, but I can only imagine it's got to be on par with Ramin Karimloo in Les Mis.
Wow.
And I would be curious to see what they did with Brian Stokes Mitchell too, because he's a very traditional kind of baritone. So I'd be curious to see what they did with his makeup. But yeah, it's an incredible thing what makeup can do, and I don't think any show says that better than Sweeney.
Next up on the Boulette Brothers. George, darling, it's time for your glow down. Oh, fabulous. The ghoul within you has come fully out.
I would watch
Listen to
that.
that.
If they ever did a Monsters of Rock Dracula challenge where they did Sweeney Todd Monsters of Rock, like full theatrical experience, I would more than watch that. So let's talk a little bit about spatial reasoning and things in Sweeney Todd, because this is one of the things that Sondheim was kind of at the forefront of early on in his career. You see it in the original Company. You probably see it a little bit in Forum, but not as much. He was kind of on the cutting edge in the idea of a play being a play. For a long time, seeing something on Broadway, and I don't know if this was the case in the West End, but seeing stuff on Broadway was kind of like you knew you were at a play, but it was going to be escapist. It wasn't really going to ever show the backside of it. But both Company and Sweeney Todd had, in their original iterations, this very mechanical feel to them. So in Company, it's the idea of the cast. In current versions, we know about the idea of Company where the cast all play instruments and the stage is very bare. In the original version of Company, there was actually this incredible mechanical contraption that was a series of elevators where they would enter and exit from. And so it was a very vertical show. In Sweeney Todd, the idea of the industrialism, the idea of the 19th century, the idea of kind of this smokestack, Great Expectations, Muppet Christmas Carol sort of Great Britain came to life in the idea that the audience saw the entire set change. They watched the people move like they were part of a machine. The whole set felt like one big machine. The wheels on like the staircases as they came in and out, there was no illusion. There was the idea of you're seeing a story, but it was very gritty. It was in your face. It was mechanical. It wasn't necessarily soulless, but it kept to kind of a very grim, dark sort of color palette. It's this interesting idea of Sweeney Todd gives in to its own mechanical nature. So by the time we get to Tim Burton, it's quite interesting that that 2007 version of the movie is still very Burton-esque. It doesn't really have that mechanical quality, but it is very claustrophobic in a way. The streets are very slim. There's never really a sunny day except for him by the sea, and that's a very artificial thing because that's in Mrs. Lovett's mind. All the rooms are slanted, but I have to imagine that Stephen Sondheim really liked that, because I think for any of Stephen Sondheim's musicals, really, except for, like, say, Assassins, maybe, I can't imagine any of the other ones being appropriate for that Tim Burton treatment. I think Sweeney Todd is probably the most appropriate. It was clear that Tim Burton didn't want to shy away from kind of the more grotesque elements of this. I can't speak for the Josh Groban version, but I will say that in all of the versions of Sweeney Todd, space is thoughtfully accounted for. That's why there's a version of it that uses a minimal set, and they've actually got an operatic version for smaller spaces. Because it really is about the space, and it really is a show about the lack of humanity and what happens when you have a lack of humanity. Because even the quote-unquote hero of this story, Anthony, is soulless in his own way because of his naivete. It's the idea of almost like the Carrot-type character from the Discworld series, where he's so out of place and on Morpork that it works because it's dissonant. And that's kind of how I feel about Anthony in this show. Johanna's kind of she's not a non-character, but in so much as that she's a secondary character, the story really isn't about her, except that she is Sweeney's kid and that the judge desires her. I could be wrong. It could be in the stage play that she's much more present, but if we're looking at the idea of characters that really influence a story, Joanna's not really a big part of the story for me. And I'm sure there are Sweeney Todd fans that hate that I'm saying that, but like the best part of Johanna is the fact that she's kind of part of these women that prophesy about something at the asylum, and the song about her, Johanna, is a really wonderful, sweet, bittersweet, melodramatic song that I like. But Johanna as a character doesn't really fit in the show because she doesn't fit in the same machinery. She's being kept caged and naive, and that all the other characters, even Anthony, show off the machinery of the city and the machinery that is this play. And so the space of Sweeney Todd, the musical, is super important in its work. Just like the sparseness of the set in Company means you actually get to experience a story instead of being dazzled by a set piece, essentially.
Yes. The lack of what one would call normal dimensions, the use of slanted rooms, the lack of a welcoming outside and such, it's all very deliberate. The purpose is to remove familiarity, safety in seeing something that you know as it is, by making everything a little bit crooked, a little bit off, as it were. It then unbalances the audience and what they're seeing, and allows them to get more swept up in the fact that it's almost as if the entire world is a little twisted in a way. And people like Johanna and Anthony, their naivety is almost a bit of a shield against that, but then it also is a vulnerability. But certainly they're swept up in the events that are going on. They're pieces of wood in this whirlpool of like dangerous waters that they're involved in. And to be frank, it's a miracle they managed to actually get out of it without getting their throats slit in by someone or other.
It's true. And they almost don't. Anthony especially has the really tense moment with Anthony versus the judge, where he's like full naivete on display, and he almost is murdered by the judge in the judge's drawing room. Like, that is one of the hardest moments, I think, in the film. I
And
really
doesn't he get sent to an insane asylum anyway?
well, he gets sent to the insane asylum chasing after Joanna. He doesn't get sent to the asylum. He just gets sent away with promises that he'll be murdered if he appears again. Which, not ideal. You don't want to do that. He also doesn't really fight back against that. He gets so hyper focused on Joanna. I don't think he ever shares the screen again with the judge after their scene. I really love the horror film aesthetic of, I almost consider the musical film its own property in a way that I don't consider that for something like Little Shop of Horrors or Hair or Godspell. There's something I really like about Tim Burton's aesthetic here in considering Sweeney Todd as a horror film before it's an opera, almost. There's something very German Expressionism, Universal Monster Movie, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, of how he sets up the demon barber of Fleet Street and how he turns kind of the world into a cartoon. Visually, it works really well. It's almost like the opening parts of The Wizard of Oz before she gets to Oz, but we never get to Oz. There's something about the intentionality of the black and white grayscale that works for me, and how the world is very twisted and I'm welcoming claustrophobic. At the beginning, we get that great shot of the sea, and even the sea is not blue, it's gray. And even coming into port, the camera pulls into Fleet Street, and we never see the rest of London except for the tops of the buildings. I think it works. It's so different from the factory ideal, but it's its own sort of ideology of pushing the horror of the story to the forefront, as opposed to pushing the dehumanization to the forefront. And I think it really works as its own adaptation of the event.
Yeah, dehumanization is very much the more the subtle themings of a lot of these properties, to be honest, a lot of these adaptations. The fact that basically humanity itself is being used to feed humanity within the city, and everyone just loves Mrs. Lovett's pies when and she's providing the these great recipes and such. There's yeah, it comes back to the factory machine ideal of people just being fed into the system. And they're, you know, until people actually realize what's going on, they're very happy to, you know, take part in it, shall we say.
Yeah,
And I want to, sorry, go on.
it does change things a bit. One thing Stephen Sondheim noted about the change from stage to screen was how the intimacy level changes, how close you are to Sweeney Todd doing his acts, how it feels like you're in the same room. Whereas in the stage show, when you have the townspeople acting as a chorus, you really can lean back a little bit from it. In the movie, you can't escape it because it's so big and in your face in a way that doesn't exist. Even the different levels, like, so in the film, when Anthony is singing Johanna, he's looking at her from across the street. In the stage show, she's up on a set of stairs about a story, not quite a story, like half a story up, but she's on this big set of stairs with Anthony looking up at her. You can kind of escape the idea that she's caged like a bird a little bit because she's just kind of up there on stairs. The film is so much more visceral about her captivity in many ways. And so it's one of those things where, like, even just taking the chorus out of it and not having the entire city be implicit and have it really just being this intimate story of self-destruction and power, it really does, it doesn't completely change it, but it really does change the context of the story. And it just fascinates me as a change in adaptation and how much Sondheim was really happy to go from a 3-hour score to this 2-hour movie event.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I got lost in my own head. I know you were going to say something, and then I totally interrupted your thought process. So.
Oh, no. It's completely fine. And I was just musing in the back of my head, wondering what other stories set within this twisted, macabre London would look like. Because really, we got a bit of a snapshot of it, but I think it has some ability to be extended out to tell other tales, as it were. But that's a sort of a bit of a tangent thought of mine.
Well, you could set like a Moby Dick story here. You could set a Les Mis story. This kind of I feel like as a genre, this kind of tragic 19th century London is something that Americans specifically like because it feels familiar, but it's so far away now. We don't think about the idea of working poor houses, but we have the Amazon warehouse, you know, kind of thing, which feels like that's where you go when you're working poor. There's something about this as a genre. There's something about the Great Expectations style of genre, this very odd, romanticized poverty, very Oliver type scenario. We see it replicated even in Marvel movies. If you think about the first Guardians of the Galaxy, they actually have a planet where there are kids in poverty where they're doing like an Oliver and Company role. And so this genre does pop up every now and again of this kind of poverty, heart of gold, trapped in an uncaring world, rears its head every now and then. But in 2007, this was one of the top 10 movies, not just movie musicals. This was one of the top 10 movies of 2007 when it came out. So I don't think there's been a version of Sweeney Todd that hasn't been received well. I think that has a lot of reasoning. It does boggle my mind as someone that people always seem to want catharsis. We even see it in Repo, the Genetic Opera, is that there's catharsis in it. And there really isn't in Sweeney. Even Toby, who's kind of the young character that could have been saved, is now completely insane. And Joanna has just seen her father and mother again, and they're both dead. And that's just a visual she's going to have for the rest of her life. There's a very Phantom of the Opera Christine Phantom thing that happens in this show, which is interesting. So,
Perhaps it is the lack of catharsis that makes Sweeney memorable. Perhaps because it defies expectation, it sticks in people's minds.
I will say people love music of this. I will say that it does have a couple of my favorite Sondheim songs. In his 80th birthday celebration that he did, by the way, he passed away just 3 days before the revival with Josh Groban and Emily Ashford opened, or when they were starting rehearsals. So he actually knew this new revival was coming. So I hope he knew how good it was because people absolutely adore it. There's a version of A Little Priest from the 80th birthday celebration where Michael Cerveris, George Hearn, and Patti LuPone do it as a trio. And George and Michael both play their like Sweeney Todds out of Sweeney makeup. And just the way that they interact with Patti LuPone as Mrs. Lovett is incredible because she stands there on stage and she basically has two different versions of the characterization of Mrs. Lovett. They both delight in the sadism a little bit, but where George Hearn plays it kind of more straight and a little bit more well, George Hearn, like George Hearn is his own entity. It's hard to explain it other than to say it's George Hearn. But Michael Cerveris plays Sweeney Todd as almost this amused, cold, slightly detached, ironic sort of character. And George Hearn, you'll really feel him give in during the course of the song. When I think about Sondheim songs, I think a lot of people probably think of A Little Priest for its wit and its wordplay and kind of its dark sarcasm. But there's some amazing. Do you have a favorite song from Sweeney Todd? I've talked a lot about stuff I like in it.
Don't I have to admit. No, I have to hold up my hands to say I don't, unfortunately. Which is why I'm happy to let you lead on this one.
Okay. I think Worst Pies in London is pretty good as a character introduction song. This is like the opposite, by the way. So there's like this theatrical thing about when you make a musical in like your first three songs, you're supposed to have like an I want song for the main hero that is going to make the character root for them. Sweeney Todd doesn't have that. Sweeney Todd is like No Place Like London, where Sweeney is talking about it like a big pit. Then we have Beggar Woman's Lament, which is where the insane wife is like trying to sell herself like a prostitute. We get the Worst Pies in London. And then we get like Greenfinch and Lindbergh into Johanna. And Johanna could be that torch song, but it's not sung by the character it's about. It's sung to her, and it kind of dehumanizes her a little bit. There's no traditional torch song in Act One for us to root for anyone, because nobody here is worth rooting for. We do get the first version of Pretty Women close to the end of Act One, and A Little Priest is the usual end of Act One, where now Sweeney is joining Mrs. Lovett's plan. They have a song called Epiphany right before it, where there's a little bit of A Little Priest in there. But yeah, Pretty Women is a great song. It's very haunting. Out of context, you don't know that it's about murder intention. You don't feel the Hitchcockiness of it. But it is a very, it's almost a Hitchcock song because Sweeney Todd is trying to flatter Judge Turpin into a stupor so he can murder him. And you don't get that out of context. In context, it's like someone's gonna die real quick. Act two is so there's this really interesting thing in Act two. There is a song, by the way, City of Fire is one of the best ensemble songs in Broadway history, probably. And this is kind of the city on fire where like everything is coming to an end type of thing. Toby has this song, Not While I'm Around, where he's confessing his love to Mrs. Lovett. And it's kind of a good match for By the Sea, Mrs. Lovett's dream sequence about her life with Sweeney Todd after he's committed all of his felonious crimes. Not While I'm Around could be considered kind of this loving, caring torch song, but this is right before the point that Mrs. Lovett is going to throw Toby into the bake room and lock him in, and Toby's going to discover that he's been eating people. And that doesn't work for anybody. What's interesting is that when you get full cast albums of the show, depending upon the show you've got, some of the songs don't appear in the cast albums just because there are so many of them. So the Wigmaker sequence, there's a song, I don't know if the song is sung or if it's just instrumental, but there's like a tooth pulling contest song. Pirelli's Miracle Elixir is, I think, the only one they probably could have cut from the movie, but that's just because I can't stand Sacha Baron Cohen. But that's a personal thing. I know it's important and you have to have it in the movie, but less screen time for Sasha is good for me. I would love to eventually hear what Christopher Lee and Anthony Stewart had and all the people that did. The Ballad of Sweeney Todd, or whatever they were having the Ghosts of London do as the chorus. I would actually like to hear that someday. Like, I hope those notes exist somewhere, because I think there's something special about that. I cannot remember the name of the song. Oh, so the song is called My Friends, and this is where Mrs. Lovett gives Sweeney Todd his silver razors back. And I always think it's interesting that she chose poverty, but she kept his silver razors for him, seeming to expect him to come back.
It feeds right into a narrative obsession.
It does. Yeah, There's something really great in that in the stage show, and it's not something get in the movie so much. Act one really does feel like it's characters versus the city. And then act two, there's a whole bunch of ensemble songs. And so you really feel the city kind of taking over the story, which is a really interesting thing to do because normally it goes from, in my mind, it goes from, big city to little intimate story. And it feels almost flipped here because almost all the songs in Act Two have some sort of corporate component to them. There's just ensembles and quintets and like trios of people singing in a way that you don't really get in the opening, except for obviously in the Ballad of Sweeney Todd while they're doing all the changes of the set piece. And again, the reveal of the beggar woman as Benjamin Barker's wife, Lucy, who did not die, is one of the most unex if you've never seen the if you've never seen it before and you don't know what the reveal's coming, she really just does feel like another background character that just happens to have some songs. So Stephen Sondheim also wrote some songs for Gypsy, so it just feels like he did what he did for Ethel Merman, where he wrote her a song to make her happy. And then when the reveal is that she's actually very important to the story, it's kind of one of those things that you don't expect. Kind of like the idea of Willow and Buffy gets magic, and you think, oh, it's cute. She's just getting a thing to fight the forces of evil with. And then the reveal that the magic is like corrupting her, so by season six, she's the big bad. It's so organic and it comes out of nowhere at the same time. It's kind of great. You love it. You love to see it. Except for the people in the story, it's very sad.
Well, yes. I mean, narratively, it works completely well for Sweeney, because it's just a sign of how much he's lost himself and how much he's lost his way, that he just gets so caught up in things, he ends up murdering the very person that started off this quest, this obsession of his, for vengeance and such.
And
And
he never spends any portion of time in the musical looking for her either. Not even before he finds out from Mrs. Lovett that she's quote unquote dead, I don't really get a sense from the film, and I didn't get much of a sense from the stage show that it was ever his goal to look for her if she was still alive. I could be wrong about that. But based upon how he says his farewells to Anthony and how she enters the scene, I do wonder if there was ever a version of the script where he goes looking for her grave. Because he never like looks for her grave. It always feels like something in his revenge gets in the way of him mourning her in a way that is more human. It's just part of the dehumanizing thing. But it's also the idea of in a world where everything is cruel, you never get time to escape in order to do the actual mourning. Because even in By the Sea, which is Mrs. Lovett's song about her perfect relationship with Sweeney, it's so full of delusion as to not really be anything real. Like it's not a vacation you can take. We've seen the sea. The sea is gray. You can't have this beautiful day at the ocean if the world is utterly gone to crap.
For some reason, it gives me Alice Madness Returns vibes, American McGee's Alice, in the sense of something that was once normal and possibly good has been twisted into a delusional world that almost feels a little fantastical in sort of how twisted it has become.
Sweeney Todd, as part of the Stephen Sondheim canon, really feels like it partners well with Passion, which is a story about a doomed love affair, I think it's set in Spain, but it's a story about a doomed love affair. A lot of Stephen Sondheim's work is a story about love and connection in a way. And this feels no different, only it's about a world without that connection. It's about a world where we're all ghouls, and the fact that we're watching this production happen kind of makes us complicit in the madness of murder. I would love to have to do a version of this where you actually do it in like a pie shop and serve meat pies throughout it. So like a dinner theater where like you're specifically going to see Sweeney Todd and your dinner theater meal is like a chicken pot pie. So like you really can't escape your complicity in it as an audience member. I think that'd be fabulous. And if anybody wants to bankroll that, I will give you my PayPal.
Well, it could very well be done. I mean, it seems to be you could be that next adaptation that comes out every 5 years.
I don't know how I would actually stage this because my favorite Sondheim show has always kind of been Company. So Company would probably be the one if I suggested. I love Sunday in the Park with George, as well. And Sunday in the Park with George shares a little bit with this show as well, in that the lead female character of Sunday in the Park with George, is a sex worker and is like an acknowledged prostitute. So there's actually the idea of class and the idea of destitution and obsession. Is something you also see in Sunday in the Park with George. You see a little bit of it of Into the Woods. Something I actually love about this show that it shares with Into the Woods is that there's something about how time moves in Sweeney Todd and about the displacement of time that you also kind of feel in the woods, in Into the Woods. Going back to the idea that it's a fable. And he, I just, as far as Stephen Sondheim's canon goes, it's probably not my favorite Sondheim show, but I think anyone that likes Sondheim, that likes what he does with wordplay, that likes how he sets his word, his world and the tone of it, Sweeney Todd has to be up there for you. If it's not, then I'd be curious to see what you love about Sondheim. But this, the film won awards, the show has won awards, the different productions of it have won different awards. Quite famously, after its first showing in 79, like one of the big opera houses, one of them was there in the showing, and they were said, if I had known this was an opera, I would have staged it at my home. And so people really do love this opera, and that's what it is. It's an opera. And I love how much people connect with Sondheim's work because it can be out there, and there is a cruelty to Sweeney Todd that could make it very alienating. But people love it. It made 9 million and some change in its opening weekend,
Okay.
which includes the UK and Japan. It made 52 million in the US and Canada and 99 million in other markets, which is pretty good. Can't beat that with a shiny stick. It has an 86% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it is a macabre musical black operetta goodness. That's Sweeney Todd, The Demon Barber of Fleet Street, and I don't think there's any way to finish musical horror May than with the joy and the deprivation. And I'm hungry for an actual meat pie of Sweeney Todd.
Well, I'm not sure I could agree with you on that, but I think if I saw a pie at the moment, I would be giving it the side eye a little bit.
I mean, as long as you don't see any, nails or fingers. That was the big problem, was that Toby was eating a pie and saw hair and a fingernail. If he hadn't seen that, I mean, who knows what the end of that show would have been like.
Who knows? Who knows? Maybe you could write a new version of it, which explores that very conundrum.
Maybe. I don't know if I would. It's a possibility, but I think Sweeney Todd, I think there's some things that would be very hard to quote unquote remake. I think there's enough room in Sweeney Todd to reimagine it, which is why it's persevered from that premiere in March of 79 all the way up to the celebrated 2023 revival. Because of the WGA strike, they're not doing a broadcast of the Tonys like they would normally, which I fully support as a pro-union household. But I can imagine that no matter what happens, I can imagine that Sweeney Todd will win something, if not several somethings. I can only imagine. Thank you everybody for listening in to this week's discussion, and we'll see you in a couple of more weeks' time. It's getting hot out there because we're getting to summer, so remember to stay safe, stay hydrated, and if you're going to be walking in your pride, which I hope you're able to do, please remember to wear sunscreen. Also, if you wear sunscreen, you won't taste as good if somebody does try to make you into a meme pie. So sunscreen, it's not just good for keeping away skin cancer, it's also good for keeping yourself out of a meat pie. And on that note, we'll see you next time on Everything Is Gay, even the straight stuff. Have a great week, everybody.